Hi, it's Fraser here, producer of Last Orders. We have a fantastic show coming up for you, but I just wanted to let you know before we start that we did have a few sound issues recording the podcast remotely. So apologies for that. You can still hear the whole thing and it is really worth a listen. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast on all things Nanny State. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor at Spiked, and this is the show where myself and Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs discuss the latest in public health killjoyism, all with the help of an invited guest. Today, we're joined by Spiked editor Brendan O'Neill to talk about TfL's junk food ad ban, Michael Gove's green turn, and the latest from the war on vaping. Hello and welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things Nanny State. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor of Spiked, and today I'm joined down the line by the IEA's Director of Lifestyle Economics and the author of Killjoys, Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, very good. And also joining us down the line today is our extra special guest, Spiked Editor Brendan O'Neill. Hello, Brendan.
Hi, Tom.
So to kick things off, let's talk about Transport for London's junk food ad ban, the rollout of which is getting more and more kind of mental by the day. So listeners will remember that a ban on junk food advertising was introduced across TfL recently. Most people thought this would just mean, you know, no ads for KFC and McDonald's or any of those other kind of eateries that people like to sneer at. But it turns out that it's been catching all kinds of other things in its net. Last month, we were talking about a woke ethical food company that was having images of butter and bacon scratched from its ads. Now we learn that TfL has been purging some of its own transport advertising for daring to feature images of cake or ice cream or packets of crisps. So, Chris, you did a little kind of investigation into this for Spectator Health. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you found?
Yes, happily. So last month, on the podcast of Andrew Dorfer, we discussed the fact that this extremely woke, ethical, wholesome farmers market type food delivery company had been taken to task over their advert for bacon and butter and stuff. And I didn't think it could get much better than that. I mean, that was perfect. Within about a week, everything I'd been warning about happened in the funniest possible way. It couldn't really have been any better unless it maybe had involved Jamie Oliver or Hugh Fernley Wittgenstall. But then we get this, which I dug up the rules. And when you look at the detail of what they had to do, it's just comical. I mean, really funny stuff. So I mean, I won't go through it all because they had to do a lot. But the main thing they had to do was change what they call their cultural maps. So their cultural maps are these kind of cartoons that I guess are somewhere around the tube, mainly, I think, for the benefit of tourists. And they just show you what you can do at each tube station, basically. So at such and such a station, there'll be a cinema. But to illustrate that, they'll have some popcorn there. But of course, popcorn's a junk food, so that has to be airbrushed out. In Brixton, I think there were people eating pizza, so that had to go. In Brick Lane, it was a picture of a curry, and that's too high in salt and saturated fat, so that had to go. And so I saw all these emails in which TfL are frantically messaging their ad agency, saying, look, we're in big trouble here because there's some people having a sandwich and a picnic in you know, Hampstead Heath. It's got to go. And there was also this advert for air conditioning. TfL were very keen to tell you how well air conditioned the tube is, which is news to me. But anyway, they were advertising that, and they used a snowman, cartoon snowman, not a real snowman, with an ice cream in his hand. And of course, ice cream is junk food. So there was several emails discussing what they're going to replace the ice cream with, and should it be a cup of coffee? And then they decided, well, no, it's not very realistic because if he drinks a coffee, he'll melt. So they replaced it with some sunglasses.
I definitely urge anyone to go and read it because the level of detail that you've uncovered is very, very funny. Brendan, the term kind of Stalinist gets a bit overused, but this is pretty mad. This is pretty up there, isn't it? Kind of screening your own advertising for anything that might be blasphemous in that sense.
Yeah, it's really crazy. I mean, Chris's article on it is brilliant and thorough and terrifying. And my favourite was, in fact, the Transport for London advert that had a picture of a nice biscuit in the shape of a bus. And they even had to get rid of that because it featured a biscuit with some sugar on it. But the thing is, there's something about this censorship which just feels really pre-modern, because what they're essentially saying is that these images are evil. You know, they're so evil they have to be completely erased from public view when people are traveling on the public transport system. And there are so many layered aspects to that which are worth picking apart. The first is this idea that people are so stupid that they will just see a picture of a biscuit and immediately go out and gorge themselves on biscuits in a way that is unhealthy. The second problem is the idea that there's anything particularly wrong with that, that there's anything particularly wrong with someone seeing an advert or an image of a burger or some popcorn and then wanting to have some of that stuff. But there's just this, I think Stalinist is actually a fitting word in this instance, because it really is this impulse to cleanse the public realm of anything judged to be incorrect or overly tempting or wicked in some way. And it just feels like, hundreds of years ago, certain words or phrases or belief systems would have been completely banned from the public sphere in case they pollute men's souls. And there's a very similar dynamic going on here, where you have these bureaucrats who are devoted to the erasure of images of food from the underground system. And I think sometimes it's really worth us just thinking about how insane that is, how utterly insane, how utterly paternalistic. It's a really very strange form of censorship.
And what was quite striking about all of this, Chris, was that the people involved seemed to know how ridiculous it was. You know, you quote one exchange between Time Out magazine and TfL's customer marketing and behaviour change manager over an ad featuring a moon that resembles a Christmas pudding. And at one point, the TfL kind of bureaucrat says, just remove the icing sugar and the holly. And so it's 100% moon rather than looking like a pudding. And then follows up with, I cannot believe I'm writing the above sentence. So is that, is that a sign of encouragement, maybe, that people are realizing how ridiculous this is? But then again, they are still going along with it, aren't they?
Well, any sane person's got to find it ridiculous in their heart of hearts. Of course they were laughing at it. They were saying, oh, we've got a picture of strawberries and cream at Wimbledon, just get rid of the cream. The real point here is the snobbery of the whole anti-obesity crusade. It was pretty obvious that when Sadiq Khan and these other public health nutters were trying to clamp down on so-called junk food advertising, they had a small handful of big American fast food chains in mind, because that's what they see as junk food. And legally, they couldn't just focus on these guys. Literally legally, you can't just isolate McDonald's and KFC and say, you're not allowed to advertise anymore. It has to have some kind of scientific backing. And so they use the HFSS system, which is high in fat, sugar, and salt. But once you do that, of course you get rid of cream. I had people on Twitter going, how can they say cream is a junk food? Of course it's a junk food. It's really high in saturated fat, probably pretty high in sugar. You can't be gorging yourself on cream. Same thing with the Farm Drop episode we talked about last month. When you're talking about junk food, you're thinking about the Big Mac. You're thinking about pizza. Well, I'm sorry. We can't just clamp down these companies just because you don't like the people who you associate with it. You've got to do the whole thing. And so the government gets itself tied up in knots when it has an agenda which has to be unspoken because it's so blatantly snobbish, but they have to kind of find a legal way to express that, and they end up taking out a lot of the things that everyone just thinks are normal, are ordinary, because they are. Strawberries and cream at Wimbledon is normal. Having a sandwich in a park is normal. Technically, yes, it's junk food, but that only shows how insane the definition of junk food is.
So, Brendan, do you think some of this stuff will just start to, collapse under the weight of how insane it is?
I really hope it does, and certainly people should push it in that direction. The thing that was really terrifying in Chris's article was the fact that some of these people at TfL have job titles like behavior change executive officer and all this kind of stuff, which is just sums up the stunning arrogance of the new elites. And you do think to yourself, imagine the mindset you would have to be in to go into that kind of job every day, where you just see it as your right and your responsibility to change the behavior of ordinary people. It really does sum up the way in which this new political class, this bureaucratic class, looks upon ordinary people as stupid, unhealthy, fat, unattractive, and everything has to be done to save them from themselves. So the fact that we have this kind of very Orwellian system where there are significant sections of the bureaucratic elite who think they have the right and the responsibility to change our behavior in a very sly, underhand, censorious, authoritarian way, that should scare everyone. That really is a pretty terrifying state of affairs.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. So as Spiked readers and listeners to this podcast will know, Spiked has no paywall and no subscriptions. It's contributions from our readers, from our listeners that keep us going and growing. So to those who already give, thank you very much. And if you'd like to make a donation, or even better, set up a monthly donation, just go to spiked-online.com and hit the big red donate button in the top right of the homepage. Anything you can give really is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show.
So next up, let's talk about the Environment Secretary, Michael Gove, who, as many will know, has been making a bit of a splash at the Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. He's been hugging puppies, banning straws, and is now proposing a national mandatory bottle deposit scheme to tackle the scourge, as he sees it, of plastic pollution. So, Chris, to kick things off, I know you looked into this and you looked into their impact assessments. Could you tell us a little bit more about what this scheme would entail and whether or not it's actually going to do what it claims it sets out to do?
Well, I genuinely came into this with an open mind because I, you know, call me a wetty or whatever, but I do think there is a genuine problem. And Gove very much proposed this deposit scheme on the basis of it saving the oceans. And straight away, I was a bit suspicious because I really do have my doubts about how many plastic straws and plastic bags and plastic bottles used in Manchester end up in the sea. So I looked at the impact assessment and I was interested to see that they don't mention the ocean at all, really, in it. There's no claims about benefits to marine pollution. They focus entirely on litter, which, again, is a valid concern, and no doubt there are a lot of bottles and cans disposed of in the streets, and probably a deposit scheme, which, to answer your question, would involve you paying a 20p or 10p deposit on a bottle, and then you'd have to go to some machine somewhere or go to a manual collection point somewhere and redeem it. But at the same time, it's a lot of hassle, it seems to me. You know, we have very, very comprehensive curbside collection in this country. It's nearly 100% of households have their they have their blue bins and their black bins collected on a weekly or fortnightly basis. And it's a very easy, pretty much costless from the point of view of households, way to do recycling. And actually, our recycling record isn't that bad. For all you hear about plastic bottle pollution and all this, all these billions of bottles going to landfill, it's 74% for the single-use beverage bottles that are going to be involved in this deposit scheme. So it's not fantastic. Some of the places that have deposit schemes, like Norway, have up to 95% recycling rates. There is probably more that can be done. But when you look at the cost of getting that last bit, you know, going from 74% to maybe 85%, which is what DEFRA thinks they could achieve, it's enormous. I was amazed that they're looking at a setup. In the first year, the setup's going to be more than £1 billion. And that is going to come from what they call producer fees, which are going to be paid to this new quango that's going to be set up, and also from unredeemed deposits. But either way, it means basically higher costs for consumers. So it's people like us who are ultimately going to foot the bill, as usual. So more than £1 billion in the first year. The running costs thereafter are £814 million, they reckon. So I thought, well, okay, fair enough, but what's the benefit? And the benefit really is tiny. They think they're going to get £37 billion worth of recyclables that they can sell. They think that they can reduce litter collection costs by £50 million. I think that's optimistic, but still not a great deal compared to the overall cost. And there's £12 million in greenhouse gas savings, whatever that means. Regardless of whether these are realistic figures, it's less than £100 million. For an 800 odd million pound outlay every single year. It's just not cost effective. So the impact assessment suddenly decides that there is nearly £1 billion worth of kind of emotional benefits for people seeing a bit less litter in the street. But they then ascribe £986 million as being the intangible psychological benefit of that to the British public, which coincidentally just pushes it over the line. It seems to me rather dubious, but even more dubious is the fact that they don't look at all at the unpaid labour that we're all going to have to carry out. You know, however many millions of households every week having to store all their empties at home, put them back in a car or stick them in a carrier bag and cart them back off to some reverse vending machine, which is probably broken, certainly have a queue in front of it, to get a voucher out that you have to take somewhere else to redeem for 40p or whatever it may be. That's real labour. That's real cost. And I estimate that the best part of £2 billion. So any realistic cost benefit analysis shows this thing is just not worth doing.
Mm. And the more you think about it, the more this kind of plastic obsession and the way in which they're going about it seems to me the most oddest and strange kind of crusade that the politicians have come up for a while. You know, the main spur for it, as you say, Chris, was Michael Gove and many other people watching David Attenborough's Blue Planet 2 and seeing these images of turtles and marine wildlife choking on plastic straws, I guess. But as you point out in the piece you wrote about this, Chris, you know, the plastic pollution is a problem, but 10 rivers transport about 88 to 95% of it, and 8 of those are in Asia and 2 of them are in Africa. So, Brendan, what do you make of the way in which this has become, you know, the plastic crusade, banning straws has become, you know, one of the things that the Tory party can at least get done and feel good about, yet it just seems to be one giant virtue signal, surely?
Yeah, I think it's almost entirely about virtue signalling, and I also thought that figure from Chris's article on Spiked was really striking about those rivers being in either Asia or Africa. And by the way, I am very much in favour of Asia and Africa going through this pretty messy process of modernisation, you know, similar to what Britain went through 150 years ago. So that's all to the good. The thing I find depressing about the war on plastic, and it really has become a war on particularly single-use plastic, is that it's made plastic into a dirty word. But plastic is such a remarkable invention. You know, this is a lightweight but incredibly strong material, which is used for so many things. You know, we all think it just is used for drinking stuff and wrapping food, but of course it's used in iPhones, it's used in furniture, it's used in refrigerators. I mean, all kinds of different forms of plastics are used in almost every modern thing that we think is good and that we take for granted. So I don't like the way in which plastic has become a dirty word, you know, indicative of how horrible humanity is, that it's creating all this unnecessary stuff. Even on the single-use plastic stuff, I think the reaction is so over the top. You know, one of the things I find most infuriating about contemporary society is those cardboard straws, because they're so difficult to use and they're so unpleasant, and it seems to me utterly unnecessary. I was recently in a cafe and there was this old man in his 80s at least who was going absolutely berserk at a waitress because he had a cardboard straw. He wanted a plastic straw and he thought the cardboard straw was unusable. That might sound like a small thing, but I actually think it's quite an important thing that people's everyday habits and their drinking habits are being radically transformed on the basis of what is largely a virtue signal. You know, if it's the case that single-use plastics are causing a particular problem, we should be offered all the evidence and all the statistics to show us that. And then the solutions just need to be much more straightforward. Better collection of this stuff, better recycling of this stuff, ideally in a way, as Chris says, that doesn't force people to have to traipse through the streets and deposit bottles and unnecessarily and so on. So I just think the whole war on plastic is irrational. If they want to propose a rational way to recycle this stuff, I'm open to their suggestions, but I haven't heard one so far.
Mm. And Chris, you say this is in the article you've written and in the paper that you wrote for the IEA, you point out how kind of costly this is. Do you see this scheme as something that's actually going to come to pass, or is this something that's going to be kind of left on the cutting room floor as all the attention shifts back to Brexit and all the rest of it?
Oh, yeah, I have no doubt whatsoever it's going to go ahead. I mean, Michael Gove has just lost his mind on this kind of stuff, unfortunately. It's very sad to see, because I think most people think he did a pretty good job at the Department for Education, but he's, God almighty, he's gone native at DEFRA. It's so depressing, and it's such an obvious response to one documentary on TV as well. You know, this is the kind of mindless government that we have now. The only question now is whether they include every plastic bottle, including like 3 litre bottles of Coke, or not. I actually filled out the consultation online a few days ago, And like all these public consultations, I don't know if you ever actually bothered to do one, but there's so many leading questions in it. So their only real question to the public is, do we do it with every single bottle, including stuff that never gets dropped in the street at all, you know? Or do we limit it to fairly small bottles? And in the consultation, it says, you know, if there's a limit, what should it be? 3 liters, 4 liters, or 5 liters? You know, the limit should be at the most 500 milliliters. But this is the way they get around it with these consultations. So yeah, I'm afraid it's bound to happen. And it's one of these feel-good things that, I mean, like I said before, when I looked at this with an open mind, I thought, in principle, I thought this isn't a bad idea. It has worked in other countries. It's only when you look at the detail and see that it just doesn't work when you layer it on top of an effective but quite expensive curbside collection system. That's the problem. It makes no sense given where we already are. There are so many other things we could do if we want to increase recycling rates, but we're not putting this stuff into the ocean. That's the point. We are not really putting this stuff in the sea. The plastic straws people are getting in pubs are going in the bin, and at the worst, they're going into landfill, and landfill is not a problem.
Brendan, just finally, not to get too kind of psychological about this, but what is it about plastic, do you think, that so enrages people? Because it does seem to kind of map onto that sense that a lot of people have, a lot of the kind of the green elite, shall we say, of this kind of disgust with modern society, that really some kind of consumerism that really summed up in the kind of single-use plastic item. Do you think that's part of what's driving this, and why, even in the face of the evidence, this kind of crusade carries on?
Oh, definitely. I think plastic really horrifies them. It makes them feel physically ill. You know, you can imagine them on the tube or something, seeing someone drinking from a plastic bottle and just feeling completely horrified by it, because it sums up the ease of modern life. To most of us, is a step forward, because it means that people don't have to worry about where their rubbish goes, and can hopefully trust that it will be dealt with in a pretty rational way. But to them, that's a horrible prospect, the fact that society has become easier for people to live in. Plastic really just sums up their contempt and their disgruntlement with how modern society is moving ahead.
Before we get into the final section of the podcast, I just wanted to let you know about a great way that you can support the podcast, you can support the show, get our message out there to more and more people, that will cost you nothing and take just 1 minute of your time. All you've got to do is give us a rating and a review with your chosen podcast provider. It really is that simple, and it will be a huge help. So thanks so much for your support, and back to the show.
So finally, let's talk about vaping. Hardly a day goes by without another scare story about e-cigs. Despite them, as we've talked about many times in this podcast, being a bit of a public health miracle, they're still something which are constantly coming under attack from this kind of unholy alliance of regulators, nanny state types, and of course the tobacco industry. And in the US in particular, the anti-vaping campaigning seems to have only been stepping up over the last over recent months. And just to kick off this discussion, we want to talk about a particular clip that was doing the rounds on Twitter recently that really was something else. So let's have a quick listen to it, and then we'll dive into the discussion. So that was a clip put out by some US-based group called Truth Initiative. So it's a kind of heavy metal public service announcement about e-cigarettes and how they're making worms addicted to mango-flavoured poison. So Chris, your reaction to that clip, which I know you blogged about, and then just a little bit about where we're at with the kind of anti-vaping crusade in general.
It was such a funny video. I had to watch it 2 or 3 times just to make sure I wasn't missing the joke. You know, just if it wasn't some kind of double bluff. It's, as you can gather from that clip, it's a kind of guar-style mid-90s, very heavy metal sound. With just these lyrics, it's honestly beyond parody. The context of this is that although in Britain we've had a remarkably sensible approach to e-cigarettes, and I don't often praise Public Health England, but in this respect, Public Health England have pretty much led the world in sensible regulation of e-cigarettes and actively encouraging smokers to switch to them, which seems like a no-brainer if you're in the United Kingdom. It doesn't seem that It doesn't seem like that in much of the rest of the world, and especially not in America. Why is that? America's a pretty civilized, developed, sensible country, generally speaking. And yet, they've had an incredible scare, particularly in the last year or so, over Juul. They've had, in fact, the same experience as Britain, actually. If you look at the statistics, smoking rate has gone way down, much sharply, much more sharply than it had done before, at the same time as vaping's been going up. And that's now starting to turn around again, actually, because of this big scare about vaping. What I think is actually going on is you've got very big vested interests. So the Truth Initiative, who made this video, they are effectively state-funded. Something happened in America in 1998 called the Master Settlement Agreement, which was this big court case in which the tobacco industry in America agreed to pay individually to the US states a large sum of money every year. But that sum of money was based on cigarette sales. So you've got states in America, virtually every state in America, is literally dependent upon cigarette sales for its income. If everyone stopped smoking tomorrow, states would be in serious trouble. So whether you like to believe it or not, these guys actually want you to keep smoking. And vaping is a massive threat to that. At the same time, it's obviously a massive threat to the conventional tobacco industry. And the tobacco industry had reacted to that in a fairly predictable way. They started investing in e-cigarettes and other reduced nicotine products. So Altria, which is basically Philip Morris, which makes Marlboro cigarettes, amongst others, have bought a big share of Juul. Makes sense. It's fair enough, you know. But the fact that they bought a big share of it means that the anti-vaping extremists, for whom this is literally just a moral crusade, it's not necessarily about money for them. They're just, you know, they're Puritans. They can say even more than they did before that vaping is a big tobacco trick. It's there to provide a gateway to smoking for young people, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. So you've seen stuff happen in America, which is just off the scale. Stupid. It's insane. And this video is a perfect illustration of that.
And I'm just struck by the fact that there are various countries around the world at the moment where it's completely legal to smoke tobacco, but vaping is banned. You know, just the ridiculousness of that is huge. Brendan, what's your take on all this?
I think Chris is right. Britain, surprisingly, has had a pretty sensible attitude most of the time. You know, even the NHS had an article on its website a few months ago or a couple of years ago about how vaping was far safer than smoking, which everyone knows, of course. When you vape, you don't get the tar that you get from cigarettes. You don't get the carbon monoxide and so on. So everyone knows that, but it's still surprising because of the public health tyranny we live under to hear public health people make that point. But I think, you know, there are still a lot of people out there. On the one side, you have the tobacco industry in the US in particular, as Chris talks about, who have a vested interest in not making vaping as popular as it might otherwise be. On the other hand, you know, there's always these scare stories about teenagers vaping. There's often scare stories about the flavors that are added to vaping, which might make them more attractive to young people and so on. So all that scaremongering is still going on. I think it really demonstrates that the anti-smoking thing, the anti-smoking tyranny of the past 10 to 15 years is really not going to stop anytime soon, because it wasn't simply about making people stub out their cigarettes. It was really an advance by the public health lobby into more and more areas of life, into the workplace, into the public house, into bus stops and even cars with children in them, and all these other various areas which they have colonized through the anti-smoking initiative. And I think what we're going to see in the coming months and years is that they're not going to be particularly happy if people are now walking around vaping. And I wouldn't be surprised if they try to institute some rules against that too, because they've got a taste of their power and they've got a taste of their ability to change how people behave and to control what people can do. So I wouldn't be surprised if, even in the UK, but certainly in other parts of Europe, we will see the increasing problematization of vaping, even though everybody knows it is far safer than smoking.
And Chris, we should say that in the US, a lot of the anti-vaping campaigning is based on this idea that there is this kind of epidemic of vaping use amongst young people, that it is a gateway to smoking. I mean, what do you make of those claims in particular?
It's remarkable, I think, how few non-smokers take up vaping. And I think, realistically, a lot of that is down to the fact that it just doesn't look very cool. Whereas the Juul, I don't know if you've seen the Juul, but it kind of looks like a USB stick, which doesn't sound that cool. I mean, in fact, it isn't, but it doesn't look as stupid as the thing I use all the time. That has probably got a certain cachet. And there's no doubt that there are non-smoking teenagers who've taken up the Juul and some who've taken up conventional vaping. But that is bound to happen. You know, if they weren't doing that, they would be taking up smoking. It's you know, you've got to look at the counterfactual here. You've got to look at the parallel universe. So if all you care about is public health, then you should still be in favor of vaping, because it's getting a whole lot of kids who would otherwise be smoking to take up vaping. And so vaping is one of those few, very few issues where libertarians like myself can find common cause with the more sensible people in public health. But there, I mean, Brendan is completely right. These people are not interested in liberty. They're not interested in letting people do whatever they want to do. For them, this is something they have to tolerate for a generation. You know, they want to get rid of nicotine use altogether. And the first step is to get rid of smoking. But the next step would definitely be to get rid of vaping.
You've been listening to Last Orders. If you enjoyed it, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support Spiked directly, please do consider making a donation. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit the big red donate button. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.